Good morning and welcome to this American Bankruptcy Institute teleconference. I'm Sam Giordano, ABI's Executive Director. Since the April 20 explosion of BP's Deepwater rig Horizon, the company's share price has fallen by roughly 50%, losing $100 billion in market value. It famously canceled its dividend under public pressure. It has agreed to pay for a $20 billion claim fund to be administered by Paysar Ken Feinberg. As large as that number is, Credit Suisse recently estimated the cleanup to ultimately cost about $23 billion, with another $14 billion in claims by businesses and individuals. BP also agreed to drop another $100 million into a fund to compensate workers idled by the administration's decision to suspend drilling for 6 months. Yesterday, the company confirmed that $100 million figure is also now the daily tab for the cleanup. The $75 million cap on damages under the Federal Oil Pollution Act is no longer operative. Indeed, many bills pending in Congress would retroactively remove any liability cap. Suddenly, the $17 billion that BP's parent company reported as profit last year doesn't sound so impressive. Prime Minister David Cameron conceded while at the G20 as much that the company could collapse under the weight of open-ended liability claims. On the management side, CEO Tony Hayward has plenty of time for yacht watching, having been ousted from his duties in the United States, while criminal investigations and grand juries loom large. The environmental degradation continues at a frightening pace as we are about to enter another hurricane season in the Gulf. And what happens when some local jury in Louisiana or Mississippi reaches its verdict on BP? The company name may then stand for beyond the pale. The facts, known and unknowable now, are no time for rosy scenarios but hard choices. The company is facing some fundamental questions about its survival. Many now say a bankruptcy is virtually certain. Today, with the help of a panel of experts, we'll explore those questions and take your questions. With me in alphabetical order are Loretta Cross. She's in Houston, a national managing partner at Grant Thornton's Corporate Advisory and Restructuring Services. Specializing in energy company restructurings, her most recent engagement was assisting in the restructuring of oil drilling company Saratoga Resources. Bankruptcy Judge Judith Fitzgerald has served the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania in Pittsburgh since 1987. A past president of the National Conference of Bankruptcy Judges, she has presided over several major Chapter 11 mass tort cases arising from thousands of asbestos claims. Dylan Jackson is a partner in the Seattle office of Foster Pepper. Among his representations, he has represented a number of future claim holders in bankruptcy cases. Peter Kaufman is the managing director of Gordian Group in New York, where he heads their firm's restructuring and distressed M&A practice. He has more than 25 years of experience in the business of solving complex financial challenges. And Bob Keach is a shareholder at Bernstein Scher in Portland, Maine, focusing on representation of various parties and workouts in bankruptcy cases, including debtors, creditors, committees, lessors, and third parties acquiring troubled companies. He is ABI's immediate past president. I thank you all for participating, and note for our audience that I've asked all of our speakers to play individual roles this morning, and so they may not exactly be representing their own personal views, but rather the views of the parties that I've asked them to represent. And so with that, let me start with Bob Keach playing the role of the debtors' counsel. Imagine you've been retained by BP to explore the option of a bankruptcy filing by its North American operation. What facts, whether they be financial, legal, operational, or even public relations, go into your calculus on how to advise the client on whether to file, where to file, and how to deal with the government along the way?
Thanks, Sam. I'll try to summarize what would probably be weeks of strategic analysis into about 5 minutes. But the first difficult decision here is going to be, whether to file at all. And that takes into account a number of factors. I mean, first, filing a Chapter 11 always poses some risk. Even though the presumption in the United States, for example, is there'll be a debtor in possession, a filing of a Chapter 11 in the U.S. would pose some risk of displacement of management by a trustee. It creates some risk that the company is at least theoretically in play. In other words, it may not have ultimate control over its own destiny. And in this case, there are also a number of issues relating to both political and public relations factors that go into effect. I'm not sure BP's PR could be much worse, so that may not be the factor it normally is, but it's certainly something you would take into account. And I think the bigger issue here and the hard discussion one would have to have with the executives and the board would be the effect of a bankruptcy filing of any or all of the BP entities on BP's global businesses and its global brand. The U.S. operations and the spill are certainly one massive aspect of BP's existence at the moment, but you're talking about a massive global company that has operations around the world, and it would have to certainly take a hard look at what the 11 would mean in terms of those global operations and global brand, and I think others will speak to that. The next big consideration, frankly, would be where one would file for insolvency relief if you are BP. One consideration would be to try to file all of the companies, including BP North America, in proceedings for administration in the United Kingdom. There may be a perception, for example, that the political atmosphere in the United Kingdom, where BP is a very important player, and I think some 15 or 20% of people get some form of dividend from BP, that might be a more hospitable environment in which to reorganize. Now, while in the UK they would have to go into administration and there would have to be an administrator, they would be hoping for what the UK insolvency lawyers refer to as a soft administration, where they could reorganize in a friendly environment in the UK. If they filed for administration, if BP or any, including BP North America, filed for administration in the UK, you would still have to file Chapter 15 proceedings in the United States in order to protect the U.S. assets and to make sure that the U.S. claims were properly directed through the U.K. proceedings. And that's where things get a little more complicated. A U.S. judge would be very concerned that the claims procedures in the U.K. were fair to the U.S. creditors. That's usually a structural issue relating to the way the U.K. laws look, but certainly a court in the U.S. would look hard at whether or not that process was fair to U.S. creditors. The other option would be to file only the U.S. operations and file in the U.S. in Chapter 11. That has, a number of considerations, some political, some simply relating to what relief may be available. And then there's the possibility of parallel proceedings in the U.S. and the U.K. And certainly my discussion with the executives and the board is going to explore all of those issues. There's been some talk in the press about whether or not BP could file a U.S. Chapter 11. In other words, given its perceived state of solvency, whether or not that filing would be in good faith and whether or not it risked being dismissed because it's filing simply to deal with environmental liabilities. I'm frankly less concerned about that. I assume there are projections that show that these liabilities could, as you mentioned in your introduction, go beyond the ability of BP to meet them. And like Manville, like a number of the asbestos cases, and like Asarco, I think you could establish a good faith filing here. So while that's certainly drawn some attention, I'm worried less about that. One of the big issues here is that if BP is as solvent as everybody believes it to be, and we would certainly explore what that means, but if its balance sheet solvency would permit it to pay all of the perceived claims on a liquidation, then it has to pay all the claims in full. So the likelihood we're going to escape paying the environmental and environmentally related claims in bankruptcy is probably unlikely if those facts are true. We'll have to pay 100% of the claims. On the other hand, we may be able to pay those claims over time. We may be able to fund whatever claims vehicle we use over time. And there's an advantage to filing bankruptcy in that respect, even if we have to pay claims in full. If the claims were to grow to the point where they couldn't be paid in full, you get some very interesting issues. Pre-bankruptcy, claims arising pre-bankruptcy, including environmental claims, may be dischargeable. But you have the problem in this case that this well is still spewing oil into the Gulf. And the post-bankruptcy discharge liabilities are likely to be administrative claims under a doctrine called the Redding Company v. Brown Doctrine. And those would have to be paid in full in any event in order for the company to escape Chapter 11. So, again, the likelihood is that some mechanism for full payment of most claims is in the offing here. You've got the particular problem, and I know Dylan's going to speak to this, of future claims. You may have claims that are not going to manifest themselves for years to come. And certainly in the U.S., there's much more, I think, experience with doing things like appointing a future claims representative and estimating future claims and the like. And therein, I think, is the biggest advantage that BP would have if it filed Chapter 11. And I think it'll only file if it's forced to file. But if it's forced to file by either its circumstances or by government action, the biggest advantage is that an insolvency filing, whether in the UK or the US, would give it a single forum, i.e. the insolvency court, wherein to work out these claims. In the U.S., you could use a claims estimation procedure of the type that's been used in asbestos and ASARCO and others. You could have a future claims representative, and you could consolidate all of the claims in one proceeding and stop BP from having to face, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of lawsuits in state courts, federal courts, up and down the U.S. The question then arises whether or not there are alternatives to Chapter 11 for that single forum option. Could you, for example, negotiate for federal legislation for a claims process? I think that's very interesting, particularly in light of the government's recent comments that it doesn't want to see a BP bankruptcy. A couple of very quick side issues, that the so-called escrow fund that you referred to, if the escrow is funded, it would certainly protect the claimants in the event of a bankruptcy. If it's unfunded, that escrow is not doing anybody any good, and the company would not necessarily have to continue to fund post-bankruptcy. There's been a lot of talk about a federal receivership or the threat of a federal receivership. It'd be interesting to see what form that would take. But in my view, the threat of a federal receivership or any attempt to create one would almost assuredly mean that BP would, in fact, file. One of the other considerations you have here is the fact that, you know, the Attorney General has been summoned to the Gulf on more than one occasion, and there have been hints of criminal investigations into the events that led to the spill. This case is going to involve very careful management of things like the attorney-client privilege and the need to manage the possibility that there may be criminal investigations of the company or senior management, and that creates a whole overlay over the process.
Thanks, Bob. You're right. We could take about 2 weeks on that. Let me shift to Peter Kaufman playing the role of the investment banker to the debtor, someone who would work with the debtor's counsel. So you're advising the company as their investment banker. How would you work with counsel to address the important cash issues and making a plan that would make the bankruptcy as successful as possible, Peter?
Sure. Thank you, Sam. I have been advising the board in conjunction with Bob. The board read my book, The Definitive Book on Distressed Investment Banking, and they now understand they need options and optionality. unlike what our government was able to do with General Motors, BP is a very different cat. BP has money, and it has options. And just because BP may be able to afford to pay something or some amount of claims doesn't mean that they should or that they will. And so my job, among others, is to help map out a clever game plan, financially based together with legal, to help them minimize how much they pay out. So I'm going to be analyzing where globally and across all of their structures, where their assets and liabilities are, whether certain assets, for example, their South American oil leases, can be transferred out of BP North America into another entity, and running scenarios about how much the spill and the aftermath might cost and compare it to various outcomes achievable through different kinds of bankruptcy proceedings. Underpinning all of it is going to be views on valuation, valuation of BP North America, valuation of some of BP North America's subs, valuation of the overall entity, and I'm going to be counseling the board that we want to delay. We've already bought time with the the unenforceable promise of the $20 billion government escrow fund, and we're talking about total damages that could well exceed over $100 or $150 billion before all said and done, and that might even be viewed to be conservative. So, just for illustration, if I believed that the value of BP North America was $100 billion and the claims are going to be over $150 billion, I would be seeking to wall off the rest of BP's assets so that nobody could get past BP North America to get to other BP global assets. So my goal is to make sure that they don't have to pay everything that people have in the way of claims. Bankruptcy would be a powerful tool, and to the extent that we are successful, Bob and I, in crafting a plan where we can get a soft administrator in England and have insolvency proceedings there where the United States and the Gulf claimants have to go for their succor, we're going to do a whole lot better than if we have to play in U.S. bankruptcy court.
I think you're right. And we'll undoubtedly, when we have our discussion, focus a lot about that sort of where to file question and the ability to wall off assets. But I want to bring Judge Fitzgerald in here. We've mentioned asbestos already, and you have a lot of experience there, of course. And let's just say, for illustration, that you're the presiding judge lucky enough to get this proposed bankruptcy case in the U.S. With respect to your experience in asbestos, are there parallels here or lessons that can be applied should BP's North American operations file? For example, could a channeling injunction, which has been used in the asbestos arena, work in a case like this?
Yes, Sam, thank you. I think there are lessons that can be learned from the Mastor experience that we've gone through in the bankruptcy courts that would translate very well to a case like BP and may even provide some advantages in the claims resolution process over those available to a company in the UK and other foreign countries. The bankruptcy code, of course, is a vehicle that we use regularly to deal with claims both in an individual and in mass context, and it is the only statute that, absent 100% agreement of all creditors, will provide a discharge for claims that can't be paid, and I'm excluding environmental concerns from this discussion at the moment and focusing only on the kinds of claims that may be likely to be filed as mass claims. The bankruptcy code in Section 524G, which applies, of course, only to asbestos claims, extends the ability to deal with future demands, as Bob was talking about a few minutes ago, where a future claims representative is appointed to represent those creditors who have been exposed to some problem and are not yet aware that they have an injury. So although 524G applies only in the asbestos context, courts have used Section 105 to incorporate the same trust type of principle and injunction principles for other types of mass tort claims, for example, noise-induced hearing loss, silica claims, mixed dust claims. And, of course, there is the class action capability in the bankruptcy court as well as the class proof of claim capability. So how does all that fit together? Well, the individual claims of pre-petition creditors can be filed and adjudicated by the bankruptcy court just as they would in any run-of-the-mill case, but so can mass claims if need be. That process usually works like this. A law firm would file a master claim for all of its clients who have allegedly been injured by the debtor, and then, assuming that that is the process that's employed, the courts would allow an omnibus claims objection process to be utilized as well. So any claims that are similar in nature like duplicative claims or claims that were filed in the wrong status, maybe filed as secured claims, but the debtor contends they should have been unsecured claims, can be filed in groups and litigated more efficiently and cost-effectively. Alternative dispute mechanisms can be invoked in appropriate circumstances, and my understanding is that that's what the $20 billion fund is supposed to do. But the problem with the ADR process, of course, is there's no way of knowing how many claims it will pay, at what level, and what will happen to the future claimants who don't yet know that they're injured. So although that's an alternative, whether it's effective in this circumstance, frankly, I'm not really sure. So if we're back to the mass claims issue, in appropriate cases, there are not proofs of claim filed at all if we're looking at a 524G type of injunction. Rather, what will happen is that a post-confirmation trust would be established to deal with both the present claims and the future demands. And it generally begins its operations through the plan balloting process, where master ballots would be submitted by a law firm for all of its client creditors, and those ballots would contain this type of information certified by counsel, things like the client's name, the nature of the claim, the class it's voting in. If the plan is confirmed and this 524G type of injunction is then implemented, the debtor now has escaped the liability for paying all of the claims that can be paid through the trust. The trust is then formed, and the claims are then processed through the trust. They're filed with the trust, and the appropriate trust distribution procedures are set up to deal with both the present and future claims on an essentially equal footing. The future demands, of course, have to be estimated, but the problem is you never really know what they are because they're future demands, and so they're not really known or knowable. And to the extent that these trusts are set up, there has to be a mechanism to fund them. Typically, the trust distribution procedures will authorize a percentage of the claim to be paid, and that percentage is capped in each category of claim for different injuries that may manifest over time. To fund it, 524G requires that the entities who are going to benefit from this injunction, the debtor, sometimes its insurers, sometimes its affiliates, will have made major contributions into this trust to assure that the funding is there to pay all those claims. There's, of course, no time to fully explain this type of operation. I think perhaps it's best just to say for today that this process has worked. It's been utilized for the last 20 years, and it has worked. There are some problems, though, that the courts and creditors face in this instance, and one of them is probably not all that obvious, and that is there's a lack of resources in the courts themselves to deal with these major, major cases. Bankruptcy judges, for example, have one law clerk. So in order to deal with a case like this, you have to figure out a way to get additional resources. And in the claims context, that plays out like this. A claims agent is usually appointed to handle the processing of claims that are filed in the case, and that claims agent is paid by the estate rather than by the taxpayers. So I hope that gives you a brief overview of what I think the lesson that could be learned from the mass tort context in a case like BP.
Thank you, Judge Fitzgerald. Let me bring in Loretta Cross next, playing the role of the financial or restructuring advisor to the debtor. We saw last week that the claims czar, claims administrator Ken Feinberg, was quoted as saying that there was no sense at all in pushing BP into bankruptcy. And so what non-bankruptcy options can the company explore? And if they do file, how might their day-to-day operations change in terms of their existing management and the like?
Great questions. First, let me say that I believe BP has many options besides bankruptcy and that they are a long way from exhausting these options. I've completed an analysis that shows that over the next 3 years to deal with the ramifications of the oil spill, BP will need to have an additional $30 billion in cash. outside of what they generate on their balance sheet. And there are a number of sources that they can get this $30 billion of additional cash from. I'm going to first go through those piecemeal options of how they might come up with that $30 billion. I believe that raising that $30 billion, finding that $30 billion among their assets is a better solution than filing for bankruptcy and the ramifications that that would have for their business partners that they lease land from, that they their oil and gas production, their joint venture partners, all of the people that they do business on, as well as a reputation. First, they have the ability to raise debt. They can issue up to $30 billion, which happens to be the number that we're talking about here, in debt, and still be at the industry average for debt-to-EBITDA ratios for E&P integrated oil and gas companies. So right now, they can raise up to $30 billion of debt and not even go outside the average. Second, they have the ability to sell assets, whether they're discrete assets that don't fit into their core strategy anymore, or maybe their strategy has shifted because of what's happened here. I've looked, and they're tangible, hard, easy-to-identify assets, such as reserves in the ground or refineries or joint ventures, have a combined total value of over $230 billion. Against that $230 billion of assets, there's only $34 billion of debt. So they have an enormous, what I would call, war chest of assets that they could go to determine strategically how best to handle this. In addition to an out-and-out sale of assets, the oil and gas business uses joint ventures, participations in wells, farm-out agreements, and other mechanisms where cash can be generated today by BP, and they can still protect their upside in those assets that they might transfer. Reduction of the capital expenditures. In the last 2 years, $52 billion in capital expenditures and development costs occurred within BP. For a short time, BP could reduce the amount of development activities or their development programs to help them weather through their cash needs. Now, to me, this is the least attractive of the options because it has implications for their cash flow in future years. Four, they can continue to curtail dividends or to reduce dividends. On average, they've paid $10 billion per year in dividends for the last 2 years. I think that until this is resolved, you can expect to see those dividends curtailed or reduced. And then fifth, you're starting to see BP look to other responsible parties. And Tony Hayward has said the other responsible parties include their working interest owners, Anadarko, Mitsui, as well as other responsible parties that have been named include Transocean and Halliburton. So you start to see them looking to those responsible parties, and in the press you've seen I've seen reports that BP has called on Transocean's insurance, and Transocean is trying to block that. And you start to see a lot of rhetoric that's coming out between Anadarko and BP. So you can tell they're starting to look to those counterparties, and you're seeing reactions to that. Those are all piecemeal solutions. But I think a more thorough and likely long-term solution is that BP, after the well is contained, may be a very likely takeover candidate. And that could happen through a merger of equals that they go out and try to approach where they can maximize shareholder value, or through takeover from other likely competitors. If they actually determine that they want to file for bankruptcy, I think that you can expect the refineries will run and the oil and gas will continue to produce. Most companies that are in the energy business that have substantial assets continue to operate even when they're in bankruptcy, especially one that has the amount of resources that BP has. However, they will have three issues. The first is liquidity. they will. It will be key for them to figure out exactly how much cash they need to get a DIP financing facility in place so that they will be able to prepay for product for the refineries, for the drilling operations, and for their production services. And so having the appropriate DIP facility will be key to them. And DIP is a debtor in possession facility. The trading operations. My belief is the trading operations have already diminished as their counterparties are not sure about the clarity of what the financial situation of BP is. And as long as there's a cloud around how bankruptcy would impact them, so I think that you would find that already people are not trading with them. But if there was a filing, the trading would come to a grinding halt. Terminations, which are forward contracts, derivatives, would come to a halt, and the company would have a real problem with their existing risk management procedures. A lot of the trading that BP does is related to managing the risk around the volatility of oil and gas prices. Once terminations occur in their trading book, there may be holes in it that would leave them exposed to market swings where they could actually have real losses. The last thing that they would be impacted with on their day-to-day operations is that all complex organizations have more detailed issues than they anticipate. And this is a very complex organization. The day-to-day demands of a bankruptcy can be really expensive for the company, and not just in dollars and cents that you pay to the professionals, but in the time that's consumed by management. So planning for a project like this is critical. You have to plan your liquidity needs, what kind of financing you're going to have. You have to plan how you're going to handle your risk management issues and what is going to happen in your trading book. And you have to plan who and what and how you're going to manage the demands of bankruptcy.
Thanks, Loretta. Let me bring in Dylan Jackson. He is playing the role of the claimant representative for the tort claims, both the present claims as well as the future claims. So, Dylan, imagine that you filed hundreds of cases and various state courts on behalf of the victims, both direct and indirect, of the spill. And so what happens if a Chapter 11 is filed? How do you protect your client's right to a full recovery? And then what happens with respect to the difference between the current claimants and the class of future claimants?
Thank you, Sam. This case is not about BP. It's about hundreds of thousands of victims of corporate negligence and greed. This is about the claimants. It's not about fat cat shareholders. So here we have a situation where myself as a personal injury lawyer and hundreds of my colleagues are trying to fight their way through a complicated and resistant claim system or in court. And we are faced with the possibility that everything we're trying to do on behalf of our clients will be stymied by a bankruptcy filing. What we need to do, what you've just heard, is the kind of resources that BP has in terms of experts, in terms of counsel, in terms of even a judge who talks about, she may have misspoken a little bit, but the words were that BP would be allowed to escape its responsibilities to claimants. Mr. Kaufman, BP will move assets so it can reduce its payments that it owes to hundreds of thousands of victims. This should make it clear to me and my colleagues representing claimants in the Gulf that we are up against a huge army of experts, lawyers, and policy issues, all talking about how to preserve BP, take care of their stockholders in England. What I first need to do is get myself a team, and I have to go to my colleagues who are similarly situated and say, look, we're going to have to shell out money. We're going to need the top legal spokesman in the country. to be our representatives to the press and possibly to Congress and others, we're going to need to hire immediately a bankruptcy lawyer who understands the system and how to work with it. We're going to have to go into the community, and we already are, I'm sure, organize community groups, fishermen's organizations, unions, so that we can speak with a voice as loud as the New York investment bankers and the high price council that BP is going to put against us. So what we would do in anticipation of a bankruptcy is to form a pre-petition committee, which shows this kind of variation in claimants, everybody from the restaurant owner to a fisherman to a union organization, and possibly even municipalities who have significant claims may even have their own committee, and be able to go forward, announce our existence as a pre-petition committee, obtain counsel and experts to assist us in this case. It may or may not be that our committee will be appointed by the U.S. Trustee's Office, which is in charge of that, but we need to be in existence, be organized, and be representative at the beginning. Our first goal, and I would say that when I'm going to change my role now, let's assume that I'm the bankruptcy counsel for this pre-petition committee, and assume that we get appointed and I continue on during the bankruptcy. The first goal is to keep the claims process that is ongoing running and the claims actually awarded and paid on an interim basis. BP has a system in place. Ken Feinberg has a system that is going into place. There's no reason, given the solvency of this company, that there should be 1 hour's hesitation in the payment of claims. And so the first goal will be to engage with the debtor, with Mr. Feinberg and others involved, and talk about a means to go to the court for an emergency order that will allow the claims process to continue and that claims would be submitted and paid. I have to turn to my private lawyers, my state court lawyers, and say, you've got to understand a reality in this case. There is a tremendous tension between the policy to get the victims paid and the amount of contingent fees that you are charging. And unless you, personal injury lawyers or state court lawyers, come up with a formula so that you can reduce the impacts of the legal costs to the individual victims, you're going to have something imposed on you that you're not going to like. So the first thing, after I get hired by the plaintiff's lawyers, is we're going to get into a little bit of a woodshedding about we've got to reduce our expectancies in terms of what the legal fees are going to be. At the same time, I need to put together a team of experts. The court is going to want to know information, and it's going to turn to the experts of the BP experts, highly paid, and often, let's just say they're paid for the kind of opinion that they give. In a recent, not too recent, but an asbestos case a few years ago, the stockholders expert thought that claims would be $100 million. The claimants expert testified to the court that the claims would be $500 million. And I wonder whether a dartboard would have been better assistance to the court in trying to figure out what the claims are. The point is the experts, none of them are going to have the slightest idea, at least in terms of estimating claims. Well, they'll have a slight idea, but they're not going to be able to give the court or anybody any effective guidance. And unless we have as claimants, competent experts to combat the kind of testimony and effort that's going to be made by BP, then we're going to lose. And we need to understand that this is going to cost money, but if but it pales in comparison with the kind of money that BP is going to walk away with and the claimants are going to lose if we're not adequately represented in this case. At the same time, we need to be aggressive. We also need to understand that bankruptcy is a place where deals are done. This is a golden goose. It lays nice eggs, and it makes incredible amounts of money. That money is the source of our payment. So we've got to listen to the business advisors, both to the committee and for BP, on what it takes to keep that cash flow going. I don't think that we would favor a closed-end trust where BP deposits a certain amount of money and then escapes, walks away. We want that trust replenished in perpetuity for present and future claimants from some portion of the profits that BP makes until the last victim is fully paid and there are no more damages realized from what has happened in the Gulf. Let me change now to the future claimants. Future claims representative has no clients, doesn't have anybody to talk to advise him, because those claimants don't even know they've been injured, and so they're not in the representative's office. What he needs to rely on is expert testimony and information about what the amount, the number and dollar amount of future claims. First thing I would do is try to figure out, or at least in this process, I would try to figure out, what are the medical damages claims? Is this a love canal kind of situation? We have no idea of the long-term medical and health implications of the oil that's spreading through the lowlands of Louisiana and other states. So the future claimants representative has got to get to push a little bit further into what the hypothetical claims or potential claims would be. The job of the future claimants is to ensure, the future claims representative is to ensure that a claimant that comes forward is paid exactly the same percentage of their legitimate claim that somebody who comes in June of 2010. In other words, history has showed us in some of these cases that future claimants statistically, by way of either caps or other kinds of administrative processes, recover less on the same claim than a claimant who knows of their injuries and submits their claim during the course of the case or during the immediate administration following the case. So my job as future claims representative will be to ensure that this trust is adequately funded, and I think the only way it can happen in this context with the unknowns that we have is that the trust be continuously replenished, possibly in perpetuity, and from a percentage of BP's future profits.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Dylan. I understand Ian Williams from London has joined us. Ian?
Yes, Sam. I'm here at last. I'm sorry.
Good morning. Good morning. Ian is a partner in the London office of Brian Cave. He's also ABI's vice president for international. And obviously, this is a cross-border potential bankruptcy. So we wanted to bring Ian in for his perspectives. We've been talking, Ian, mostly about a potential filing of the North American operations and what the implications might be. What about a proceeding in the UK? Might there be some advantages for the parent company to use that approach as opposed to a BP bankruptcy where the company may be, for lack of a better term, just get beaten up by this process?
I think that there would be certain advantages. As I understand it, BP PLC UK owns the American subsidiaries, and therefore their only assets are the shares in those subsidiaries. They don't have a direct interest in BP US's assets as such, only in the shares of those companies. Now, it may be open for the UK to argue, were it to come to that, and I'll come to that in a second myself, that the center of main interest of those US companies is actually in the UK. That although the registered place of business of those US companies is in the US, it's a rebuttable presumption under our cross-border insolvency regulations that the center of main interest is actually in the UK, because that's where the power in the equation is, and the true control of those companies comes from the UK. So it would be perfectly open for us to file those companies into administration in this jurisdiction. That may not be sustainable, but it's only capable of challenge once you've done it. So if BP were to be particularly obtuse and, in a sense, snub the US, it could try to reorganize in the UK. As far as I can tell, however, the issues are slightly more complicated than that. In that, the procedure, the only advantage I can see of BP filing for an 11 is for what Dylan, I think, has just been talking about, is an ability to deal with the claims through the US process, and we don't necessarily have the same degree of sophistication in our administration for dealing with those kind of processes. What we've had in a parallel may be Federal Mogul, where Federal Mogul filed in the US to deal with its asbestosis claims and also filed in the UK, but the UK essentially continued to trade as if it was in a debtor in possession regime and there was a cross-border protocol. But I think the main points to make are on this with regard to BP is not so much where it would file, but whether it would file, and in what circumstances would it file, and what would be the political implications of it filing or being forced to file. And if you think about that, BP is the Pentagon's largest supplier of oil, and 40% of it is owned by U.S. investors. Now, if the Obama administration continued to be what some people may say are necessarily hostile towards BP, and decided to form some kind of receivership or sequestration, that may force BP to consider its options in terms of its U.S. operations, and that may force it to act in a way to defeat the receivership by filing either an 11 in the U.K. in the U.S. or coming to the U.K. and filing in the U.K., which would be considered to be particularly politically hostile. But I think the political ramifications are important here, because we have to assume that our new coalition government is literally just come into power. Mr. Obama's not been in power for long, and there are considerable trading relationships at stake here. So forcing BP to file would be considerably risky from, in a sense, the political perspective. Obviously, the stock price doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the asset value of BP. Its assets don't necessarily move. It's essentially people speculating on its outcome. But I think what Loretta said is particularly important, is that there are many other options for BP out there other than filing. But certainly BP could take the hostile view, if pushed, and find a way to file the entirety of its operation outside the U.S., not in the sense to defeat the U.S. creditors and the U.S. claimants, but just to wrest control away from the U.S. courts and the U.S. political interference.
Sam, this is Peter Kaufman, investment banker to the debtor. May I throw in two more comments, since I used only a little bit of time
earlier? Sure.
First of all, with respect to what Loretta said, that BP could raise $30 billion here. Well, I'm the investment banker of the company, and I'm going to tell you that until and unless there is some settled views about bounding BP's liabilities, and until the bouncing ball stops moving on all the various fronts, the capital markets are not going to be enthusiastic about putting a lot of new money to BP. Maybe a little bit at the margin, but certainly not $30 billion. And to Mr. Jackson, I guess I'm the New York investment banker that he was derogatorily referring to, But let me educate you about something, Mr. Jackson. BP is not a golden goose for you and your claimants. BP and its board of directors is first and foremost looking out for its shareholders, and it will do everything that it legally can to explore its options to minimize payouts and maximize values and recoveries for its shareholders. And if it is pushed by you or the federal government too far, absent an overall solution that makes everybody a little less than happy, then BP assuredly is going to explore and likely implement insolvency proceedings that are going to cause the following issues, among others. Number one, it will cause a huge delay in claimants getting recoveries. What could well happen is that the federal government of the United States, and therefore its taxpayers, might have to front money to the claimants and turn around and be the ones to go after BP, because a BP insolvency is not going to mean a swift resolution and money flowing quickly. That's the leverage BP has here. That's why Kenneth Feinberg said that it would be a horror for claimants if BP filed. So BP has some real leverage here that people aren't adequately taking into account, and I wanted to make that point.
Okay.
Peter, this is Loretta. Certainly, there are individual assets that have no liabilities associated with them right now that could have asset-based loans placed on them. It might be expensive money, but
well,
there's certainly...
I've got my investment banking view, and you're entitled to yours.
Okay.
But is it not the case, Peter, that BP's assets exceed its liabilities by more than $100 billion U.S. dollars? I mean, and it has, like, at least, as I understand it, $24 billion in net operating cash. I mean, in this market, there's going to be somebody out there, surely, who's going to be prepared to say to write them a check. Maybe not for $30 billion, but it's going to have options, surely.
Oh, well, absolutely. And my job is to help develop those options from all sorts of things: asset sales, capital raise, etc. But believe me, this board of directors is going to get advice from me, and I believe from Mr. Keech, as well as you, that it needs to understand its options down various scenarios and making various assumptions, and it will be counseled to pick the best combination of courses of action that are going to result in a minimal payout with a maximum return to its shareholders.
Sam, Bob Keech, again, as counsel to the debtor BP, and working with Ian on this cross-border case and with Peter, I think, frankly, and then we I'll be brief, and then we can let our friends in the media ask some questions, but the concern, frankly, we're going to have is the sentiment expressed so eloquently by Mr. Jackson, and that is that claimants are likely to see BP as funding some kind of claimant's trust or, you know, remediation trust or both in virtually perpetuity. Frankly, that is the problem that we are trying to avoid. And despite the considerable solvency and liquidity of BP, no company wants to be tethered to that kind of future liability virtually forever. So the structure that Ian talked about, and just to spin it out a little bit, the way it might look, is that you could have the BP entities, including the BP North America entity, file for an administration in the UK, and, you know, we're hoping that's a soft administration. We would then file Chapter 15s in the U.S., asking for orders and aid that would create the kind of claims process that Judge Fitzgerald carefully described, but which would direct the decisions on the amount of those claims and the timing for payout to be made through the UK courts and the UK administration process, where we're likely, frankly, to get much less hometowned on the amount and whether or not, frankly, we can estimate and cap those claims. It would be an interesting blend of the U.S. and U.K. processes, and we might make some new law here, but frankly, if BP is forced to file, and I think it only files if it's forced to file, what it would be attempting to do is prevent the very scenario that Mr. Jackson described.
This is Judge Fitzgerald. For one point on the comparison with Federal Mogul and how that process played out between the U.K. and the U.S. claims, The UK process finished earlier and actually was a more expensive process for the debtor, as it turned out, than the U.S. process was. The U.S. plan was eventually confirmed, incorporating the terms of the administrator's proposals in the U.K. That's how it worked ultimately in the United States. And I also have to take, issue with one statement that Mr. Jackson made, and that is that cases have shown that future demand holders are paid less than current claimants. My experience in reading hundreds of annual reports for trust indicates that that's actually not the case, that typically the initial payout percentage is set at a lower number, and the issues that are faced is that current claimants are demanding, as the trust distribution percentage changes and usually increases over time, that they get paid a supplemental distribution, and the issue is whether or not they can. So I think there are some issues going both ways. In some instances, future claim holders have been probably paid less, and in others, they've been paid more.
Got it. Let me pause and ask our media folks on the line if they have questions of our panel.
And we will take our first question from Alistair Barr of MarketWatch.
Hello there. I was just interested, given that some of BP's debt is trading, or was at least a week or so ago, trading at sort of 90 cents on the dollar, 91 cents on the dollar, does that imply that investors think that, I'm trying to reconcile that with the fact that the shares are still have value. Do you think the bond prices are implying that the equity should have no value?
Well, I think that it probably is indicative of the risk that people see that BEP has right now. So if you look at it almost like a discount, an original issue discount, and the rate of interest that's on those bonds, you equate what the market sees as to what new debt, or even new debt would be even higher than that rate.
Got it. Okay. That makes sense.
But we've got an investment banker on the phone here. Peter?
They're busy switching phones to the cell because this has gone way over. So I apologize. I didn't hear the question.
Okay.
I was just asking about the discount to par on some of BP's bonds right now. What implications that has for the equity value? Whether that's a sort of trade that's implying that the equity has no value.
Well, you know, the bond. I certainly respect the bond market's views of valuation more than I generally respect the stock markets. But anytime you see bonds starting to trade down from par, it's certainly an indication that the bond market is indicating some discomfort, depending on how big the discount is, with the company's ability to make them whole. And that goes to my earlier statement that you know, there's a huge uncertainty out there, obviously, and you know, in uncertainty, you get people that are, you know, a little more skittish about taking a new risk. But, you know, somebody who could lend money to assets that currently don't have liabilities but end up in an overall British insolvency proceeding might not be too excited about that.
Other questions?
Well, I had another one, which was if BP ends up... Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. If BP manages to cap or get this relief well and actually, you know, stick some concrete down it and actually stop it finally, how would that change things, do you think?
Well, from the standpoint of planning for the company's filing or deciding whether to file, the fact that it has continuing discharge is definitely a factor. If the discharge were to stop, such that we, you know, all claims that are going to arise are essentially arising out of events that have taken place. There's no more discharge. The chances of being able to deal with those claims effectively in a proceeding goes up. On the other hand, there may be less reason to file because we now are somewhat more able to begin to define the universe of future claims. So it's definitely a factor. I mean, a complicating factor in planning for any alternative here, whether it's bankruptcy or non-bankruptcy, is the fact that you have, you know, continued discharge. And under U.S. environmental laws, that means you have continued accrual of liability and liability claims.
that would not be cut off by a bankruptcy filing. So it's definitely a factor. Thank you.
Other questions?
We'll go next to Eric Morath of Dow Jones.
Hi, I wanted to ask Mr. Kaufman, I didn't get a kind of a clear view as to how likely do you see a possible filing? Some of the others kind of spoke to that, but I was hoping you might be able to give me your views.
Here's what I think is clear, and then we'll talk about what isn't so clear. What's clear is we're going to be prepared to file. We're going to know our options, and what we're going to do in a very cold-eyed, measured fashion is measure the potential outcomes in and out of chapter, and depending on which insolvency proceeding we take, versus what is our exposure and payout outside of Chapter 11. I can assure you that if the alternative is one or more insolvency proceedings in the United States and or the United Kingdom, or being asked to fund for Mr. Jackson and President Obama an unlimited amount or more in civil liabilities and continue to face criminal liabilities, then I think that decision is going to be made pretty easy for us. So, you know, when Gordian Group advises governments and boards of directors, we counsel everybody around the table to get the best help they can financially and legally so that everybody can understand the size of the gun and the bullets that everybody around the table has. And from that, you can try and develop a workable, elegant overall solution. And that's what's needed here. BP is going to be prepared to have that discussion. I would hope that Mr. Jackson and the government and everyone else is going to be prepared to have that discussion. But it's not going to be a one-way street. It's not going to be, we must continue to pay an unlimited amount or more and continue to be beat ahead like a financial pinata. Because we do have options, and as my counsel, Mr. Teach, noted, pretty tough for our public image to get any worse. So we're going to be prepared to do whatever. I think it's going to depend on the reasonableness and rationality economically of the other people around the table as to whether we pull the trigger.
Thank you.
Okay, and at this time, we have no further telephonic questions.
Great. Thank you, Michael. We are out of time for today. I want to thank all of our panelists for their lively and insightful discussion. We thank our media members also for joining us. You may follow up with any of the speakers via our public affairs manager, John Hartken. Until next time, then, this is ABI Executive Director Sam Giordano signing off. Thanks.